Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an early witness to Trump's Oval Office insanity, who, in contrast to the generals and others now leaking to journalists and authors, actually tried to warn the public about Trump's frightening behavior as president in an op-ed he wrote for the New York Times under the title Anonymous back in 2018. Miles Taylor, the co-founder of the Renew America Movement, a coalition of over 150 members and former members of the Republican Party calling for strengthening the rule of law and restoring government ethics, joins us to discuss what it was like inside the Oval Office dealing with a dangerous, delusional, and ignorant president. The author of A Warning, he served as chief of staff to the former Secretary of Homeland Security in the Trump administration, and his anonymous op-ed provided the first insight into White House chaos, administration instability, and the people working to keep Donald Trump's reckless impulses in check. And he warns us that today's GOP is the number one threat to our national security. Then we'll examine the revelations from an international consortium of journalists who have uncovered a list of 50,000 phone numbers of journalists, human rights activists, and politicians who have been targeted by the Pegasus spyware, which the Israeli company NSO sold to governments intended to be used against criminals and terrorists. Joining us is David Kay, a clinical professor of law at the University of California, Irvine, who was the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Promotion and Protection of Freedom of Opinion and Expression, and he's the author of Speech Police, The Global Struggle to Govern the Internet. We'll discuss his op-ed at the Washington Post, Global Spyware Such as Pegasus is a Threat to Democracy. Here's how to stop it. Then finally, we'll look into the disconnect between the deadly new strain of COVID, the Delta variant ravaging the country, particularly in red states with low vaccination rates, and how former President Trump is now the chief spokesman for the anti-vaccine movement, encouraging Americans not to take the vaccine because they should not trust Biden, along with election results and the fake news. Lawrence Gostin, University Professor and Founding O'Neill Chair in Global Health Law at Georgetown University's Law Center, joins us to discuss how Trump is adding to the death toll he is already responsible for as he puts millions more Americans at risk. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org as either the Pacifica network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Miles Taylor, the co-founder of the Renew America Movement, a coalition of over 150 members and former members of the Republican Party calling for strengthening the rule of law and restoring government ethics. Having served as chief of staff for Kirstjen Nielsen, the former secretary of the Department of Homeland Security under the Trump administration, in 2018 he wrote an anonymous op-ed for the New York Times, providing eyewitness insight into White House chaos, administration instability, and the people working to keep Donald Trump's reckless impulses in check. His subsequent book is a New York Times bestseller, A Warning. Welcome to Background Briefing, Miles Taylor.
Ian, thanks for having me. Good to be with you.
Well, good to talk to you, Miles. And frankly, my hat's off to you for writing the anonymous op-ed at the time back in 2018 when you were still in the White House. And I'm sure you were being hunted quite energetically.
But I'll say this, working in the Trump administration was a pride swallowing siege every single day. So, there had to be some way to communicate that. And fortunately, once I unmasked myself, enough of my former colleagues came forward that we did what needed to be done. We made sure that this guy did not remain in office. But I still think we're dealing with the aftermath in a way that's far more severe than most people had anticipated.
But I bring up the fact that this happened in 2018 with what's happening now, where you have a flood of revelations coming from former generals Milley, Mattis, Kelly, and McMaster, who are on the record or off the record with a bunch of authors now who have these damning books that are coming out. So my question, and I'm sure this a lot of our listeners feel this way, how come the generals didn't speak out earlier?
Look, I think that's one of the central questions. And it's one of the greatest disappointments that I've witnessed in my professional career in Washington, D.C., that so many of these folks behind the scenes didn't think that Donald Trump was merely incompetent. They would say that they thought he was a threat to the fabric of our republic itself. These are things that people said at the time in the administration, in private conversations, at dinners or after meetings in the Oval Office. Yet they held on to those notions all the way through an election cycle. And I think that's what's unconscionable. I can understand why some people, it took time for them to figure out when the appropriate moment was to step forward. I went through the same considerations and determined that really stepping forward wasn't going to matter unless it was the election year when people were paying attention. But for those people to say he was a threat to the fabric of our republic, yet not inform the voters of that threat before they made a crucial decision, that I think, again, is unconscionable. Now, the way that some of these officials, I think, can show some penance for that failure is by coming out and continuing to tell the truth in their own names and vocally, because we're still dealing with threats from this authoritarian strain in our politics that Donald Trump has tapped into. So that's what I think folks like General Milley and others should do. I understand that some of them are still in the military and can't necessarily get that information out as others normally would. But we still need the cabinet secretaries from the Trump years to step forward and say their piece. And we haven't seen it nearly at the level as we should.
And of course, General Kelly, when he quit, he did say that the American people should be more educated about who they vote for. And that was obviously a dig at Trump, but not really sufficient. I mean, it's true. But I, as a journalist, Miles, I did my homework in 2015 and 2016 when Trump came on the scene, and I talked to a number of leveraged buyout and other businessmen in New York who had meetings with Trump, some set up by Goldman Sachs and others, you know, those kind of meetings. And without exception, they all said within 5 minutes, I wanted to get out of the room. I couldn't believe this guy. He was completely obsessed with himself and in his own world. Narcissism doesn't even begin to describe what they experienced. So is it true that had you got a camera into the Oval Office early in that administration and let the public see 5 minutes of this guy on the job, would the presidency have ended?
Well, I'll tell you what, it nearly did because the people around him saw what he was like in those circumstances. I mean, the only reason that there was discussion in this administration of the potential need to invoke the 25th Amendment and have the president's own cabinet replace him was because people saw what they saw in the Oval Office. And again, I can't emphasize enough, this is Donald Trump's own handpicked team would see him up close and say, this could break very badly, so badly that we may have to, for the first time in history, invoke that amendment in a way that it's never been invoked. Now, those conversations didn't go very far because when they got played out in private, people said, well, actually, what that's going to do is spark a civil war in this country. And they didn't mean that hyperbolically. I mean, they knew it would cleave this country so much to have, you know, Donald Trump pushed out by people who are unelected. But that was the depth of worry. And you know, I'm glad you say bringing a camera into the Oval Office, because that's my opinion on what the responsibility was of every ex-Trump administration official after they left, is to act like America's body cameras in that administration and to come out and say the truth. And look, if they felt like the truth was he was a wonderful man, it was very stable, he's an excellent president, then come out and say it. But that's not actually how most of them felt. And so there was an obligation to come out and expose the reality to the American people. Now, you mentioned my old boss, John Kelly, who is a wonderful man and a patriot. And, you know, while I wish that, you know, General Kelly had been out there even more during the campaign, towards the end of the campaign, you know, we did get him to get out there and say what the reality was. And John Kelly's quote to CNN at the time was something along the lines of, Donald Trump is the most flawed person he's ever met. I mean, he went on and said he's transactional and he's pathetic more than anything else. You know, one of the most flawed people I've ever known in my entire life. So, you know, you did have some of that. And certainly based on the books and the interviews you saw during the administration, there were a historic number of people around the president that opposed him. His former chief of staff, national security advisor, secretary of state, secretary of defense, secretary of homeland security. I mean, it was unprecedented. But most of those folks stayed relatively quiet and they let their underlings speak for them. And that's something that I think we need to address is, you know, we need to make sure that people aren't afraid to speak publicly. And when I was trying to recruit people, Ian, to campaign against the president in the fall, a lot of those cabinet members wanted to join the team, but ultimately ended up declining because they feared that it would hurt their financial prospects, that their families would be threatened. Those weren't illegitimate fears. A lot of people who came out lost their jobs, their homes, their marriages, their personal security. But look, if democracy's on the line, that's what's got to come first.
And again, I'm speaking with Miles Taylor, who's the co-founder of the Renew America Movement, a coalition of over 150 members and former members of the Republican Party, calling for strengthening the rule of law and restoring government ethics. Having served as chief of staff for Kirstjen Nielsen, the former secretary of the Department of Homeland Security under the Trump administration, in 2018, he wrote an anonymous op-ed for the New York Times, providing eyewitness insight into White House chaos, administration instability, and the people working to keep Donald Trump's reckless impulses in check. His subsequent book, a New York Times bestseller, is a warning. Well, I think what Kelly said, which I'd paraphrase rather clumsily, that the American people should really be more educated about who they vote for. But I believe very early in the administration, Trump said to Kelly when he was going on about his border wall, he asked Kelly, why can't the Marines shoot the Mexicans coming across the border? And Kelly apparently said, Mr. President, my Marines, they're good kids, and you cannot put them in a situation like that. Did that happen?
Yeah, unquestionably. And in fact, on more than one occasion. I mean, this is what people need to realize, you know, especially people who are supporters of Donald Trump. And this is coming from a Republican who wanted and, you know, had hoped that this president would stabilize an office. You know, once he was elected, he was my last choice in the Republican field. But, you know, we want the commander in chief to be stable and have good people around him. But that didn't end up being the case. On multiple occasions, Ian, the man talked to us about wanting to find various ways to gas, electrify and shoot migrants at the border. We're not talking about someone who's misunderstanding the rule of law. We're talking about someone who flagrantly and deliberately wants to defy it for quite malicious purposes. I mean, with Donald Trump, cruelty is not the end result. Cruelty is the point of these policies. He had such deep anti-immigrant animus that it led him to cook up all kinds of bizarre schemes for how to misappropriate the authorities of his office. I mean, seeing that up close rocks you to the core. I mean, that's why I was perfectly willing to blow up my own life to talk about it, because the repercussions go far beyond Miles Taylor's little life and how that's going to affect it. I mean, he wanted to do sick and dangerous things, and it was only because you had a thin line of people willing to say no to him that the even sicker things didn't get implemented. But look, that didn't stop policies, ugly policies like family separation, from going into effect. And so at the point at which it became clear that saying no to Donald Trump was no longer enough, that he was just going to do bad things anyway, that's when it was incumbent upon rational people in that administration to quit their jobs, get out there and speak the truth. Some did, others didn't. History will judge the silence, though, I think pretty harshly.
And how much did you and others trying to push back, and particularly those that work to keep Donald Trump's reckless impulses in check, how much were they undercut by the enablers and the cheerleaders? Like Stephen Miller, for example, was it a battle? In other words, the sensible ones are trying to say, you can't do this, Mr. President, and you've got this kind of Iago-like figure whispering in Trump's ear, you know, the most heinous and evil impulses.
Yeah, I mean, it was daily the rational people waging war against the radical people. And what I would say is this: the first year of the administration, folks were for a period of time, cautiously optimistic that there were enough rational appointees in the president's administration that they would be able to keep him in check, keep him focused on the rule of law and trying to implement a relatively, you know, reasonable conservative, you know, Republican agenda. It of course spiraled way beyond that, because if you can give Trump credit for anything, it's that he has a well-honed radar for people with a conscience. He sees them, he identifies them, he deletes them. And that's what began to happen. Trump began to dismantle those guardrails around them. He knew the people who were willing to tell him what he needed to hear, and he knew the people who were willing to tell him what he wanted to hear. And he wanted to keep that second category. So he systematically began eliminating the people who would challenge him. It was just like, you know, The Apprentice, except with vastly higher stakes, those being the safety and stability of American democracy. And he played that game on a national scale. And he would use that threat of firing someone or humiliating someone as a way to try to keep them in check. He was very open with cabinet secretaries about this. He would muse among them about firing different ones all the time, because it knew it made people afraid of him and more willing to bend to his will. Once that started to become very clear that that's what the game was being played in year one and year two, that's when I think the jig was up. The idea that I said in the anonymous op-ed of, look, the guardrails are the people around him, and hopefully they hold, that thesis was roundly disproven. My thesis was wrong, because ultimately it relied on the guardrails staying in place, and Trump peeled them away. So the final guardrail was the people themselves. And look, the only reason he was defeated was because of 40,000 well-placed votes in swing states around the country. I mean, if you really cut down the numbers, about 40,000 or so, you know, moderate Republicans who would have voted for Trump, who flipped and voted for Joe Biden, and some election officials and a handful of other things, that's what made the difference. It really was the people were the final guardrail, and that almost wasn't enough. So, you know, look, if there's one lesson to take away from all of this, it's that the dangerous authoritarian strain Donald Trump brought into the American political system did not disappear with his failure to win re-election. It has continued, and it requires a lot of those pro-democracy elements in the country to stay together, namely moderate you know, and rational Republicans aligning with Democrats to make sure something like this doesn't happen again.
Well, indeed, Trump is unique in all American ex-presidents. You know, Jimmy Carter built homes and George W. Bush painted pictures of little dogs. This guy controls the Republican Party. It's breathtaking. And lately, he's going even further off the deep end, because we have a real crisis in this country with the resurgence of COVID, with this new Delta strain. And it's hard as it is to understand at the moment, when you need people to get vaccinated, what is Donald Trump doing? He's joining the anti-vaxxers, encouraging people not to vaccinate. It's unbelievable.
And not only that, Ian, but he's convincing mainstream Republicans to join him. And that's why I genuinely consider today my party, the Republican Party, to be one of the biggest national security threats to our democracy, is because its figurehead, Donald Trump, firstly, is responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Americans. I believe he's personally responsible for that. But two, he's responsible for fanning the flames of an anti-democratic movement in this country that aims to rewrite the rules of the game to rig them in favor of one political party over another. That's an enormous threat. That's a once in a generation threat. And I don't say that lightly. I mean, I'm a national security guy. My career's been focused on ISIS and Al-Qaeda, fighting the Russians, the Chinese. That's what I care about. But it became evident during this administration that those threats were not the biggest threats to the future of our country. They were the president of the United States himself. That's pretty chilling stuff. But I mean that seriously. And we need to think about how we thwart that kind of a threat, because, you know, the call, as they say, is coming from within the House. And that's a much more insidious threat to deal with.
Well, just in closing, Miles, it is a bit of an irony, is it not, that Trump and his supporters keep talking about the deep state, and there is no such thing as a deep state. In a way, I wish there were a deep state, because January the 6th would not have happened, and it did happen, literally, because there's not a deep state, but there was a kind of deep state of Trump's, and that's exactly what General Milley was worried about. when, after the election, Trump put in Ezra Cohen-Watnick and Kash Patel and these proteges of Devin Nunes into the Department of Defense. And apparently, according to these new books, Milley's quoted as saying they're not going to effing succeed. But they came close, did they not?
They came way too darn close for comfort. And I would agree with your point. There is no deep state. When Donald Trump said the deep state, really what he was referring to is good civil servants who would, you know, follow the law. And he was very, very frustrated that all of the things that he wanted to do with the powers of his office, he couldn't do, because people would tell him it was illegal, or people would rule against him, or the courts would rule against him. I mean, that's why he would tell us on various occasions he wanted to get rid of the judges, because he was tired of judges ruling against him. He quite literally meant we need to get rid of, you know, certain judges and certain courts in the country. Why he would say in meetings to us he was jealous of Kim Jong-un's political system, because Kim could do whatever he wanted, and he could, you know, take out people he didn't like. I mean, these were comments that the commander-in-chief of, you know, the freest you know, world in the country, commander-in-chief of the military, the freest world in the country, was saying. That's deeply disturbing. And I think now our challenge is going to be to figure out how we de-radicalize a lot of these sycophants that Trump has created, and a lot of the people who are going to try to mimic him politically in the future. That's going to be a big challenge. That's going to be a generational challenge for us in this country. And it starts with the American people. And it starts with, you know, shoring up pro-democracy elements in our political system. And that's one of the things that I'm now focused on, is we're trying to go out there and offer support for investing in a deeper pro-democracy bench in races around the country, and making sure that pro-democracy Republicans defeat the radicals where possible, so that we can get our country back. It is the national security issue of our time.
But just in closing, can you weaponize the truth in the Gospel of St. John? The truth shall set you free.
It can be weaponized. It is both our chains, and it's both the chain breaker. And I think that's the challenge here. Truth can be weaponized in such a way as to spin it into disinformation. I think that's what we've seen in recent years. But also, it's our only way out of this mess is shining a light. And really, what we've learned politically in this cycle is people won't see the light, unfortunately, unless someone from their tribe shows it to them. If someone from another tribe shines the light, they won't believe it's light. They'll think it's something else. So it needs to happen from within the tribe. And in this case, that means within the Republican Party. The reform's got to come from within, and people from within need to be able to speak to others in the tribe and say, this is how bad it was. We have to move on. Otherwise, they're not going to do it. And that's going to be a difficult undertaking, but we've got to start somewhere.
Well, Miles Taylor, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Miles Taylor, who's the co-founder of the Renew America Movement, a coalition of over 150 members and former members of the Republican Party, calling for strengthening the rule of law and restoring government ethics, having served as chief of staff for Kirstjen Nielsen, the former secretary of the Department of Homeland Security under the Trump administration. In 2018, he wrote an anonymous op-ed for the New York Times, providing eyewitness insight into White House chaos, administration instability, and the people working to keep Donald Trump's reckless impulses in check. His subsequent book, a New York Times bestseller, is A Warning. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the revelations from an international consortium of journalists who have uncovered a list of 50,000 phone numbers of journalists, human rights activists, and politicians who have been targeted by the Pegasus spyware. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, David Kay, a clinical professor of law at the University of California, Irvine, who from 2014 to 2020 was the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the promotion and protection of the right to freedom of opinion and expression. He is the author of Speech Police, The Global Struggle to Govern the Internet, and his work addresses, among other topics, the ways in which artificial intelligence technologies implicate human rights issues, the global private surveillance industry, and its impact on freedom of expression, and the growing repression of freedom of expression globally. And he has an op-ed at the Washington Post, "Global spyware such as Pegasus is a threat to democracy. Here's how to stop it." Welcome to Background Briefing, David Kay.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And this Israeli company that developed this Pegasus spyware, NSO, they say that they only sold it to legitimate buyers in terms of governments and anti-terrorist operations, etc. They also said that they did not sell this spyware that infects iPhones and Android devices, that they did not sell it to human rights abusers. But the countries that they sold it to, among them are Azerbaijan, Bahrain, Hungary, India, Kazakhstan, Mexico, Morocco, Rwanda, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Many of those are not exactly have a sterling human rights record.
That's to put it mildly. Yeah, this is a problem of, we're focused here on one particular company, although we should also be talking about an industry that provides spyware around the world. But the evidence in the case of NSO Group and its Pegasus spyware is that it's been used by human rights abusing governments around the world. It's been used against journalists, activists, opposition figures, and so forth without any constraint. And so for NSO Group to say we only sell it to rights respecting governments is really undermined by the evidence that, you know, forensic and human rights organizations have identified over the last several years, to be honest.
But will these revelations curb NSO's activities? I think the problem is that there aren't too many suppliers of these devices on the market, and governments clearly want them.
Absolutely. There's a demand. I'm not so sure there's a supply problem. Part of the problem here is that this is an industry that operates in the shadows. You know, it's incredibly opaque. There are very limited export controls, whether we're talking globally or domestically. So, you know, we don't even have, I think, a real good fix on the size of this market, but there's clearly demand. And so the tools to constrain a company like NSO Group are, yes, on the one hand, reporting, whether by human rights groups or by journalists, and bringing pressure in that sense. But what we really need is a long-term agenda that involves export controls that are identified and hammered out at the international level, and then governments around the world have to implement. I mean, that's really where we need to start. And, you know, right now we don't see that happening. Hopefully this reporting will kind of push some governments, including the Biden administration, to initiate that kind of process.
And the reporting you're talking about, David Kay, came out over the weekend from a global consortium of news organizations, including the Washington Post, joining the French Paris-based journalism nonprofit Forbidden Stories. And of course, we're talking about Israel's NSO Group that sold its marquee spyware Pegasus to clients around the world. And they're being used against journalists, human rights activists, and politicians. And that the fact that they're used against politicians has got to get a few of those attention. Don't you think the opposition leader in India, Rahul Gandhi, now that he knows that Modi has been listening to his phone, he must be a little bit upset?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, this is where we've been heading for years. I mean, nothing about the reporting yesterday is and reporting that I suspect we'll see over the course of this week, nothing about it is really surprising. I mean, the truth is these tools have been out there. There have been reports for years about the use of this particular technology. I mean, there was a kind of groundbreaking report in the New York Times a few years ago out of Mexico that showed how Pegasus was being used across the country in Mexico by by military and law enforcement actors in order to spy on these same kind of targets, you know, on journalists, on opposition figures, on activists, on journalists, on lawyers working in this space. So, you know, there's nothing particularly surprising about it. The surprise, in a sense, is why governments haven't woken up to, particularly democratic governments, haven't woken up to the threat that these tools pose to something they, at least, you know, in their statements, seem to care about, which is the health of democratic societies and the viability of democratic societies in the face of illiberal attacks. And, you know, this is a real opportunity to kind of say, you know, say, here, we don't only say this, that we care about democratic society, we're actually going to do something about it. And that includes constraining this industry.
Well, the consortium released from a list of 50,000 phone numbers of people that have been targeted by NSO group and through its spyware Pegasus. And you just mentioned the New York Times breaking the story earlier on Peña Nieto, the former president of Mexico, who used NSO services and Pegasus spyware. Among this list that was published, there's the phone number of the Mexican journalist Cecilia Pineda Berto, who was twice on the list, actually. And this happened a month before he was murdered. So there does seem to be a cause and effect there.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, it's hard to, without further reporting and investigation, it's hard to know the connections between the use of spyware and the implications for particular individuals. You know, there's also some evidence that people who were close to Jamal Khashoggi were also targeted specifically by Pegasus spyware in the run-up to the killing of Jamal. So, you know, actually getting evidence about the connection between the surveillance and these attacks is really important. I suspect there will be more reporting that actually shows the tight connections between surveillance and then, you know, actual physical attacks on individuals.
Well, you mentioned Khashoggi, and this investigation that we're talking about that was released from this consortium just over the weekend found that the spyware was installed, Pegasus was installed in Khashoggi's fiancée's phones days after his murder. And that also Khashoggi's ex-wife's phone was targeted with spyware between September 2017 and April 2018. So take us back to that moment when it's discovered. What exactly did they do, Pegasus, to your iPhone? I mean, how do they infiltrate the iPhone? Because I understand they infiltrate it in such a way that they can actually get everything. They can even get live audio and live video of you talking and who else is in the room and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it has apparently an amazing capability.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, essentially, this kind of technology can transform your iPhone into a real-time spying device. You know, collecting everything that you are, everything you're communicating, everything you're hearing, everything you're saying, and basically transferring that back to servers that, you know, may be controlled by NSO, but certainly, you know, back to the clients that they've sold this tool to. So the way it actually gets onto your iPhone is pretty simple. I mean, I think anybody today is familiar with, you know, phishing exercises, right? Where an individual will send you an email or a text. You have no idea who this person is. You don't know where this is coming from, but there's a link and it's, you know, it says something maybe that seems familiar. Maybe they have some knowledge about your interests, about your work or whatever. And, you know, you look at the link and you click on it because you think that it's legitimate. Well, lo and behold, what happens is, you know, you click on that link and the mere fact of clicking on it allows the spyware to be installed onto your phone. And that's, you know, it's as simple as that. There's also, by the way, something known as zero click installation, where merely getting the call on, for example, on your WhatsApp, although I think WhatsApp has plugged this in the interim, but merely getting the call would serve the function of installing the malware onto your phone. Once it's on your phone, it can basically not necessarily control your phone, but, you know, gather all the information that your phone is receiving and, you know, exporting, basically.
And you mentioned WhatsApp, David. WhatsApp sued NSO, the Israeli spyware company, what was it, back in 2019, I think it was? And
right,
they banned
correct.
Them from
yeah.
their platform.
Yeah. Well, WhatsApp identified a whole series of intrusions by Pegasus malware using the WhatsApp platform. And, you know, this is, you know, this is a direct interference with the platform, with its terms of service, but especially it's a direct interference with their users' sense of privacy. And it's an interference with the business of WhatsApp, which is, you know, I think particularly for people around the world, one of the main ways that people communicate these days. So that was a real concern, a real threat. And WhatsApp and Facebook, which owns WhatsApp, sued NSO Group in U.S. federal court.
Well, it looks to me as though the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, who's considered to be the author of the murder of Khashoggi, and I don't think there's much doubt about that. Of course, Trump denies that happened. It looks as though he used Pegasus via WhatsApp to embarrass the richest man in the world, Jeff Bezos, to out his affair with an actress, which led to his divorce.
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence. And in fact, a colleague of mine and I in the UN highlighted this publicly about a year and a half ago. A lot of evidence that suggests that that the Crown Prince, MBS, actually used his relationship with Bezos, who he had met on one of his trips to the United States. He actually used that relationship in order to get to Bezos's communications. And I think that the suggestion here and the evidence here really underscores how these are transnational tools of repression. I mean, these are tools that can be used for surveillance, for embarrassing people, for intimidating them, just as much as they can be used in order to, you know, attack journalists and opposition figures and others who are simply in dissent or simply critical of government. So, yeah, it's, the evidence that we have is overwhelming, and it's clearly time for governments around the world to find a way to constrain it.
So, David Kaye, in the last few minutes, let's talk about what you have written in your op-ed in the Washington Post, global spyware such as Pegasus is a threat to democracy. Here's how to stop it. Let's deal with the here's how to stop it.
Yeah. So, look, this is a problem that we could think of as having two or three different sides, right? On the one side is the problem of its export, right? So these are tools that are typically made in democratic countries or in places, you know, in places like Israel or in Europe or the United States. And there's no global agreed set of norms to constrain the export of these tools. So the first thing that we need to have done is that governments around the world, in, you know, using existing forums for these kinds of export control discussions, they need to come to an agreement as to what that export control should look like. In other words, when can a government authorize the sale and transfer of spyware to other governments, to clients, to law enforcement agencies around the world? Presently, there is no set of agreed norms. We need to do that first. The second part of it is that, you know, around the world, governments are simply using these tools, you know, to violate human rights of users and really to undermine democratic processes and reporting and so forth. And so in addition to having an export controlled regime, you also need to have rules that focus on, you know, what governments can do with this technology. And it has to have some bite to it, right? It shouldn't just be like a finger wagging exercise where you say to governments, you can't use this against journalists. If it's shown that governments are using it this way, they should simply be blacklisted from getting this kind of technology. They should be highlighted as really improper recipients and purchasers of technology that, as some of the industry, the companies say, is, you know, where it's to be used for counterterrorism and anti-crime initiatives. Well, it's not. So there needs to be a real accounting for those who are using this stuff improperly. There's a range of other steps that could be taken that might get too granular and wonky, but those would be the things that we could do as an initial matter.
Well, David Kaye, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, Ian, my pleasure. Thanks for having me and for your great questions.
Thank you, David. And again, I've been speaking with David Kaye. He's a clinical professor of law at the University of California, Irvine, who from 2014 to 2020 was the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the promotion and protection of the rights to freedom of opinion and expression. He's the author of Speech Police, The Global Struggle to Govern the Internet, and his work addresses, among other topics, the ways in which artificial intelligence technologies implicate human rights issues, the global private surveillance industry and its impact on freedom of expression, and the growing repression of freedom of expression globally. And he has an op-ed at the Washington Post, Global Spyware Such as Pegasus is a Threat to Democracy. Here's how to stop it. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing how Trump is now adding to the death toll he is already responsible for as he puts millions more Americans at risk by encouraging them not to be vaccinated. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lawrence Gostin, University Professor and founding O'Neill Chair in Global Health Law at Georgetown University's Law Center, where he directs the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law and the World Health Organization's Collaborating Center on National and Global Health Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Gostin.
Thanks, Ian. Lovely to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And we have this extraordinary disconnect in the country where you have a new strain of COVID, the Delta strain, ravaging the country, particularly in a lot of the red states and the southern states where the vaccination rates are low. But you also have the former president of the United States who has a lot of influence. And I don't think any other former president has the influence that Trump has. He, in fact, controls the Republican Party. He's now joining in with the anti-vaxxers, saying people are refusing to take the vaccine because they don't trust this administration. They don't trust the election results, and they certainly don't trust the fake news. So is there any way to deal with this? Are there any laws against this kind of irresponsible behavior, encouraging people to risk their lives?
I mean, it's really, you know, quite disgraceful. You know, he has a First Amendment right to speak, but also social media companies have the duty to take him off their platforms. And both Facebook and Twitter have done that. He is really thoroughly discredited. And when a former president of the United States spouts conspiracy theories about a life-saving vaccine, you know, we all just need to drop our heads or shake our heads and say, you know, how can we elect a person who is literally willing to put American lives at risk? And make no mistake about it, if an individual doesn't get vaccinated and if they're persuaded by the president, that could lead directly to, you know, a serious illness, a hospitalization, or even a death, and many of them.
But this is happening, and it will happen, right? I mean, there will be a lot of deaths in states with a low vaccination rate, and the very among the very people who listen to Trump and take his advice.
Yeah, I mean, that is the problem. With vaccines, you need a very high overall vaccine coverage. Say with a childhood vaccine like measles or polio vaccine, you need to have, 95% of the population vaccinated. But the problem is that you have pockets of places where there are like-minded people who don't get vaccinated. And that means you get clusters, and those clusters can also move from state to state. It is a problem, exactly in those states that have the lowest vaccination coverage. They're also the states that are most likely to be politically conservative. They might have the president or their governor telling them that vaccines are not safe, or in many cases, governors like Ron DeSantis in Florida have, passed laws forbidding businesses from even asking about a vaccination status, and that's dangerous.
Well, you've got senators like Bill Cassidy on Fox News Sunday when he was asked about his state's woeful vaccination rate in Louisiana, of course. The Republican senator declared that Americans don't trust government. I mean, he's not being exactly helpful, and he thinks that Biden's call for people to get vaccinated is somehow partisan.
Yeah, if we really send a message that you don't trust government, it means you shouldn't take your cancer medication. You shouldn't take your diabetes medication, because those are, government-approved medicines. The truth is, and it's really the God's honest truth, is that the COVID-19 vaccine is far safer and far more effective than any treatment that we have and that we routinely take. So it makes no sense to cast doubt on them. But that's what's happening. How do you, when somebody says that black is white or night is day, and you don't agree on what is just a basic fact, you're in trouble as a country.
So you've got Trump now joining the anti-vaxxing movement, and it is growing. It's not just amongst uneducated people. It's also in affluent areas like in Marin County and out here in Los Angeles, in the Pacific Palisades. The other day I noticed these signs on that they'd stuck on buildings and on telegraph poles, a picture of the Soviet hammer and sickle. But instead of the hammer, they had a syringe. And then you've got these Republican members of Congress, making speeches against needle Nazis, saying that the federal government attempts to vaccinate you, that's a slippery slope towards confiscating your guns and Bibles. I mean, talk about insane rhetoric, but yeah, this is what's happening out there.
Yeah, I mean, well, let's first take the hammer and sickle, and would the public really like to get the Sputnik V Russian vaccine as opposed to the American messenger RNA vaccines by Pfizer and Moderna or Johnson or the Johnson and Johnson vaccine? And as far as Nazis, somebody's Jewish myself, it really is insulting to compare a COVID vaccine campaign to the Nazi regime. It's more than insulting. It's hurtful.
Well, I'm astounded that people can't see the obvious, and that is that until this new strain came along, this Delta strain, the numbers of deaths had dropped dramatically because of vaccinations from a high at the beginning of the year down to, extremely low numbers. So that should be unbelievably clear evidence that the vaccines were working. How come that doesn't penetrate the consciousness of all these people who are believing in the lies of Donald Trump's?
Well, you know, all I can do is tell you and your viewers what the facts are. You know, right now, there have been hundreds of millions of doses administered in the United States. There have been 3 billion doses administered globally. In my 30 years working in public health, I've never seen a vaccine that's more safe and effective. These COVID-19 vaccines are as good, if not better, than the vaccines that rid the earth of scourges like polio and smallpox. Do we really want to be overrun by a virus when it's within our power to do something about it? I mean, I tweeted today just asking, you know, a simple question. You know, we have a choice as a nation. You know, we can all roll up our sleeves and get a jab and be healthy and secure and go back to a relatively normal life. Or we can refuse, in which case there will be more people in hospitals and dying. And the choice is actually that simple.
Well, what I find particularly offensive about this situation is you mentioned Governor DeSantis in Florida. He had his vaccination jab done in secret along with his own family. And the same thing happened with Trump. He had a vaccination along with Melania, and they did it in secret. And, of course, we know that Trump got COVID and was very, very sick. And the White House aides, according to these new books that are coming out now from eyewitnesses to what happened inside the White House that are leaking furiously to various authors, apparently some of the more sensible people around Trump thought, finally, now that he's got COVID and has a near-death experience, that he's going to be responsible and encourage people to get vaccinated. And, of course, the opposite happened. He took his walk across from the helicopter when he got discharged from hospital. He was pretty shaky and went up and stood on the balcony and just stared out, you know, in this kind of Mussolini pose. But apparently he had wanted to, in that situation, pull open his jacket and show underneath a T-shirt with the Superman logo on it. That was his idea. In other words, he was a Superman getting over this virus largely because of extraordinary treatment that no average American had access to. And instead of warning people and being responsible, he just wanted to seem like he was a tough guy. I mean, God help us.
If President Trump were not president at the time and he was treated like an ordinary American, particularly a low-income or African-American, he could very well be dead now because he's of an advanced age. He's got multiple pre-existing conditions, and he refused to mask and distance, and he would have had a really close death experience. What can I say? I mean, time and time again, we've seen that, you know, wanting to kind of promote science and public health is somehow thought to be un-American. And President Trump does have a lot to explain. You know, I do not believe myself to be an ideologue. I like to kind of look at politics from an impartial, middle of the road position, but I care about the public. I care about equity and justice. And I refuse to condone political leaders that will not serve the best interests of the nation. And that's what's going on.
Well, Lawrence Gustin, in the last couple of minutes, there's been an alarming report coming out of Tennessee where the head of the vaccination program for the Tennessee government, the Republicans in the legislature fired her because she was encouraging teenagers to get vaccinated. And they, of course, are the group that needs to be vaccinated more than any, since most of the more vulnerable elderly people have already been vaccinated. They fired her, but they not only fired her and stopped her program to encourage vaccination, they stopped all vaccinations altogether. I mean, straight out of the playbook of the lunatic fringe of anti-vaxxers.
Yeah, you know, I actually have inside knowledge of that case. And, you know, what it comes down to this is when a state public health officer recommends to the public in the state to do something that is allowed by federal and state law, and they get fired for it. What a sad day for America. Literally, she was promoting a vaccine for a group that had been approved, authorized by the Food and Drug Administration, perfectly lawful within the state of Tennessee, and gets fired for literally following what the law requires and what her duty requires as a public health officer. That's jaw-dropping.
Well, Lawrence Garston, I thank you for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. I always enjoy being with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Lawrence. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Garston, who's a university professor and founding O'Neill Chair in Global Health Law at Georgetown University's Law Center, where he directs the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law and the World Health Organization's Collaborating Center on National and Global Health Law. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.